Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Vegan Proteins Muscles by Brussels Radio. My name is Giacomo.
And I'm Danny.
And this is our 59th episode. So what's up, Danny?
Not a whole lot. It's Friday afternoon. It's been a crazy, crazy work week, personally, for me. I don't know about you, but I've been getting my butt kicked at work, which I'm not complaining about. But yeah, my brain's a little fried, so naturally we would be recording one of our more technical podcasts today. Of course. How are you?
Me? Well, not to say that I'm not affected by your stress, because I definitely feel for you. But I got some of my own projects going on, but nothing too crazy. Honestly, personally, I'm getting deeper into my training, so my fatigue levels are going up, and I'm sort of adapting to that.
Oh my god, Giacomo did a caffeine deload last week. He did zero caffeine last week whatsoever, and he was miserable, people. Miserable.
I warned you, though. I said, look, I think I gave you like a week or 2 weeks notice. I was like, look, I am going to be a miserable person.
Well, thank you for living up to that. That was really fun.
And on day one, what did she do, ladies and gents? She was like, you're miserable. Immediately told me I was miserable on day one of my deload.
I mean, if you've ever had caffeine every day of your life for 2 years and then not had it at all, you're pretty miserable right from day one. So, I mean, I wasn't wrong.
Dare I use the word awful, but what I gotta say is getting back on the sauce, as I put it, day one, back with caffeine, I was like, I'm going to get the nicest cup of coffee. I woke up 5 o'clock in the morning, just like craving that hit. And then finally, Danny wakes up around 8 o'clock and I was like, hey, Danny, you want a cup of Starbucks with me or something? And she goes, I want the fastest cup of coffee you could possibly get me. And I just like lickety split left and it was like, yay, mission accomplished. Because usually...
I remember saying to Giacomo, like, how much coffee have you been drinking? Like that you needed... that you needed to completely cut it off entirely, and also that you are this miserable. Because I drink one cup of coffee a day. In my darkest prep days, I think I was up to 3 cups, and not like, you know, 20-ounce cups, like a cup of coffee a day. How much coffee were you drinking a day, Giacomo?
I really didn't keep track. I think it was more along the lines of how long I've been drinking coffee.
But how much, though?
Probably 3 to 4 cups, I think.
Pretty sure you told me 5, but...
Who's counting?
It's like, oh my god, how has your heart not exploded? Anyway, so yeah, it was an interesting week. Speaking of coffee, you know what coffee's really high in that no one ever talks about?
Phytoestrogens.
And what are we talking about today?
I don't know. Soy and all of the misinformation out there about phytoestrogens that soy contains and the effect that it has on the body.
That'll be it. Today we're going to be talking about soy, and it's one of the number one nutrition questions that we get. It's also one of the number one assumptions that people come to us with. Like when they're filling out their initial intake questionnaire, which is really, really in depth. Once we get started talking about nutrition, a lot of people say, I avoid soy, I don't do soy, I'm soy free. And of course we respect whatever anybody wants to eat, but we'll often ask them like, what's the reasoning behind this? Like, is it an allergy? And a lot of times it's a fear of the estrogenic properties of soy.
So soy contains phytoestrogens, and without knowing more about that, you hear the word and immediately you see the word estrogen as part of the word phytoestrogens. I started getting into learning about nutrition in 1995. It's been a while. And for as long as I have delved into the topic of nutrition, I have seen there be all kinds of controversy out there when it comes to soy. And back in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was pretty much accepted that soy isoflavones contained phytoestrogens, and that these phytoestrogens would mimic estrogen in the body. That basically phytoestrogens are the plant-based version of estrogen, and it would have an impact on one's hormones. That is where this information came from. Now, when you look back at the research, a lot of it came from one source, the Weston Price Foundation, and it was heavily, and I mean heavily funded, by the dairy industry, and it had an agenda.
Well, we're going full conspiracy theory right at the beginning. Is that what we're doing?
No, let's back up.
All right, so we'll hold off on the conspiracy theories. We'll get there, I promise.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
So first of all, what is soy? Soy, it's a legume. It's a bean. It comes from Asia. You eat soy in soy milk, tempeh, miso, tofu, some mock meats that are out there, edamame. So most soy foods contain protein, heart-healthy fats, potassium, fiber, iron, calcium, magnesium, vitamin B6. And there are also a lot of soy products in a lot of highly processed foods. So I think that's one of the reasons that it gets a bad rap right out of the gate is soybean oil, for example, is in almost every single food. It's like, you know, it's like high fructose corn syrup. It's, you know, kind of the devil when you hear about it. But soy in its natural state actually has a lot of health benefits. Sorry for all that bird noise, guys. We got a lot of birds around our house.
That's my fault. There was a little lady across the street who was selling birdhouses, and I had to get one, and now we have a little bird family right outside Danny's office.
So Giacomo mentioned phytoestrogens, so I think we should talk about what exactly phytoestrogen are. Phyto meaning plant, estrogen being a mammalian female hormone, right? So phytoestrogens are compounds that are found in plants. Phytoestrogens bind to the same receptors that estrogen binds to. When they bind, estrogens cannot bind to those receptors, right? So there's a receptor, it's for estrogen. The phytoestrogens can bind to it, but if it does, then there's no place for the estrogen to bind. So it therefore minimizes estrogen's effects. Hopefully that gives you like the basic gist. Now I started by saying that phytoestrogens are found in plants. In any conversation that you have with somebody about nutrition, just a casual conversation about phytoestrogens, soy is going to be the only thing that is mentioned. I guarantee you it's going to be the only thing that comes up in conversation. Here are some other foods that also contain phytoestrogens. Coffee, which is how we started this conversation. Coffee, tea, broccoli, flax, beer, carrots, oranges. I could go on and on. They're found in all kinds of foods. But when someone drinks a glass of orange juice or a cup of coffee, people aren't running around screaming, "Oh, you're gonna grow boobs from the phytoestrogens." Like, it's just soy. Why is that? Why is it that soy is the devil when it comes to phytoestrogens?
So back to my earlier thought, when you want to find the answer, unfortunately, all you need to do is follow the money trail. And when you look back at where all the research came from, it was heavily funded by the dairy and animal agriculture industry because soy was becoming more popular at the time. I even remember going to a race back in the early 2000s and soy was on the up and up and they were serving it to us at the end of the race. And there was increasing demand for a food that clearly had heart health properties to it and other benefits to it as far as reversing disease. And as the research was coming out, there was other research being promoted and advertised, smearing the reputation of soy as a food product that was going to affect your hormones and cause all kinds of problems.
So let me spell that out in plainer terms. The soy industry was beginning to threaten the dairy industry. If I recall correctly, and I could be wrong, I think the Weston Price Foundation, their big shtick was raw milk, right? Like raw unpasteurized milk. I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
Again, I could be wrong, but the dairy industry was threatened by the soy industry. So they started dumping a lot of money into research to find out, you know, what skeletons were in the closet of soy. Now it's kind of funny because we know that we can make dairy products out of so many things besides soy. But back in the, you know, 90s, for a long, long time, it was soy milk or nothing, right? So I think that's an important thing to bring up. So it's not really a conspiracy theory. It's just what actually happened. But I can see how it sounds like a conspiracy theory. Why is there all this research about soy phytoestrogens and there's not all this research about coffee phytoestrogens or tea phytoestrogens or beer phytoestrogens? It's because nobody dumped all the money into trying to research it to expose it as something that was bad. So let's actually talk about why somebody might be afraid of increased estrogen in the body.
Well, increased estrogen in the body can throw off the state of balance of your hormones. For a male whose estrogen increases, it can affect their ability to gain muscle.
I mean, it can affect a whole hell of a lot more than that.
And most especially for a woman, like with your hormones being a much more delicate balance, to raise one of them like that artificially, yeah, I mean, I definitely wouldn't want that in my system. Absolutely not.
It can cause all kinds of sex hormone problems to have increased estrogen. So for a guy, that could actually be growing breast-like tissue and gyno, basically. If your estrogen is high, that can happen. Increased estrogen would kind of lower your testosterone balance, which could likely lead to balding. Lots and lots, you know, erectile dysfunction could happen. For women, there are increased risks of certain cancers. For men as well. Like, there are absolutely reasons to not want excess estrogen in the body. Hormones, like Giacomo said, is a very delicate balance. And if they're out of whack for a period of time, there are serious health repercussions. However, we keep conflating phytoestrogens with estrogen, and they don't act anything alike, really. I compare it to the difference between hemp and marijuana. They look the same, they kind of grow the same, but if you smoke one of them, you're gonna get really, really high. And if you smoke the other one, nothing is gonna happen, I assume. But, you know, they're not the same. Remember when we were trying to get, like, hemp to be big in the States because it's so sustainable? Mm-hmm. And people were afraid all the kids were going to smoke it. And it was like, no, that's actually not how it works. They're different things.
Yeah.
And it took a long time to get people to realize they're completely different things.
Yes, hemp protein powder even. People were scared of it.
Yeah, in fact, it's still illegal to send it to some countries, right?
I don't even know anymore.
I'm certain, because when we ran our store, sometimes people would order from other countries and we always put in free samples and they would say, please do not put in any hemp-based free samples because it will get confiscated at customs. Anyway, I digress. The point, phytoestrogens and estrogens are not the same.
What I find particularly peculiar, and I mention this a lot, but I think it bears mentioning at least one more time, I find it weird that those who seem to fear soy the most are outside of the community of plant-based and vegan athletes. It's those who are literally consuming the hormonal secretion of a cow, and they're consuming cow's milk, and they're concerned about ingesting hormones. And when you think about it, it just doesn't make sense why they would be that concerned about consuming plants when they're literally consuming the hormonal secretion from an animal.
Yes, it's true. We just plant phytoestrogens and actual estrogen are very different. But in dairy from an animal only is produced from a pregnant female mammal that causes their mammary glands to secrete milk for their baby animal. Like, it's literally an estrogenic secretion. So I don't even take what non-vegans say about soy even like a hair seriously, because it literally makes no sense whatsoever. So I don't feel like we need to tackle that. I think most of the people who do listen to this podcast understand that soy is definitely far less estrogenic than dairy milk. But I want to talk to the vegans and the plant-based folks who listen to this podcast about, well, we already know dairy's not good for us, but is soy good for us? Why and why not?
You mentioned that the phytoestrogens bind to the estrogen receptors, thus preventing the estrogen from binding. And it may have somewhat of an anti-estrogenic effect on the system. This is where it gets interesting. Now, back in the day, 10, 20, 30 years ago, the tests were primarily done on animals. And as of recent, now the tests are being done in humans. And this is where we're finding health benefits to consuming soy, right? What a concept.
So in the rodents, particularly, so the first tests were done on rodents. The studies were across the board in terms of testosterone levels in particular. In some studies, it raised testosterone. In some studies, it lowered testosterone. In some studies, it did nothing to the testosterone. But rat studies and mice studies don't translate very well to humans, in general, which is why they should all be ended anyway. But what is much more interesting is the human studies Giacomo was about to tell you about.
Well, I got a couple. The first one is from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition from Messina. And this study showed that there was an anti-estrogenic effect specifically in premenopausal women, which was shown to help them prevent breast cancer. Pretty important. Another study in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, this was a study on 24 men, and at the end, their testosterone stayed exactly where it was in the beginning. Those on the part of the study, and it was randomized, but those who were consuming 7 times more soy than the low soy group, actually, not only did they have the same level of testosterone as when they started, it also showed that their PSA levels decreased, their prostate specific antigen levels, which basically means that they have a lower chance of developing prostate cancer. So once again, showing for both men and women, anti-carcinogenic properties were shown.
And I mean, I don't think there are any studies on this, but I assume that it would stand to reason that there would be similar results to other plants that also have phytoestrogens, like coffee, like flax. Just an interesting thing I thought of.
One other thing, and last study for now, I promise, because I'm sure you have some stuff to share as well, Danny. In a study from the National Center of Biotechnology Information, in this study, phytoestrogens were actually shown to have an interaction with osteoclasts and osteoblasts. And these two things are responsible for building bone by way of collagen and calcium. And the phytoestrogens actually were able to help osteoclasts and osteoblasts build bone in a non-estrogenic way.
One of the things that I found interesting in some studies was that phytoestrogens could possibly suppress the clinical symptoms of menopause by decreasing endogenous estrogen. So endogenous is just the estrogen that you normally have that you produce. I don't understand the mechanism by which that happens, but it does appear that consuming soy may make those crummy experiences of menopause, like hot flashes and waking up in the night and just weird periods until your period stops, could decrease those symptoms. I thought that was pretty interesting. But something that I think could be beneficial for people across the board is that in these studies that suggest that phytoestrogen can reduce total cholesterol and improve heart function. And I wonder, I would have to dive into this study specifically, but is the reduction in total cholesterol and the improvement in heart function, is that from consuming soy, or are they replacing meat and dairy on the plate with soy? So is it the inclusion of soy that protects against cardiovascular disease, or is it the exclusion of meat and dairy?
And that's where the studies basically say that it's inconclusive as far as the reasons why. I would not be surprised if that had something to do with it, though.
It is also suggested that soy and isoflavones specifically can reduce high blood pressure through a vasodilation effect. So that was in a study where they had 6 months of women that were postmenopausal taking isoflavones every single day, and it was shown to increase endothelial vasodilation. Again, I don't think a lot of this stuff, like all of these protective effects, I don't think they're unique to soy. You know, protection against cardiovascular disease and lower your high blood pressure from increased vasodilation. Like, you could say the same thing about kale. You could say the same thing about broccoli. And I think that is the point that a lot of people are missing, is that you could say a lot of these same health benefits about any plant, because soy is a plant and it's really not that unique. For me anyway, that's the biggest takeaway. Way back in like 2007, when I was trying to learn so much about this, I would read an article that said soy was bad, and then I would read an article that said soy was good, and I didn't know how to read research at the time, so I was like, I don't know what to believe. And then one day it just occurred to me that it's just a bean, and I wasn't sitting there freaking out about whether chickpeas were good for me or bad for me. It's just a bean that has been demonized by particular researchers, more or less. So as interesting as all of this research is, and I do think it is, and I could go on and on and on, because soy has been studied to goddamn death, basically. And the human studies largely show health benefits Certainly there are some studies that show, you know, unfavorable results for soy, but if you look at the breadth of studies, most of them show some kind of health benefits. But I think it's cool, like, yay, go soy. But also, I don't think it's that mind-blowing either. We could say this about all plant foods. Phytoestrogens affect blood sugar regulation. It's proven that lower incidences of chronic disease is found in East Asia, where people consume soybeans containing isoflavones. Phytoestrogens are associated with weight loss. Literally, I could read through these over and over and over again. Phytoestrogens help to minimize hormone-dependent tumors. They're great, catchy headlines. They are. I definitely am all for the inclusion of soy into a well-balanced vegan diet, unless you have a true allergy. And I'm not talking about one of those sensitivities you gave yourself by not eating it for 3 months. I'm talking about an actual allergy. Including it, I think, is beneficial, but I also don't think it's anything special.
Is it worth bringing up hypothyroidism and when you need to take a medication and how you need to basically space out when you're consuming soy because it can affect the medication itself?
I mean, I think that a lot of medications have lots of interactions that we should know about and we often don't know about. I don't know why these things aren't just discussed when you pick up your prescription. When I was in high school, I drank plenty of grapefruit juice that for sure was counteracting my birth control, but nobody ever told me that. I mean, thank God that worked out all right, but that could have been pretty disastrous. So I do think it's important to know what foods interact with your medications, and if soy is one of them, which it is for some thyroid medications, then you probably shouldn't eat it right around when you take your medication. Or if you don't want to eat it at all, that's fine too. I don't think anybody has to eat soy because they're vegan. I don't think it's a requirement. I think you can absolutely be a soy-free vegan, soy-free vegan bodybuilder, even a soy-free vegan bodybuilder with high protein goals. But I do feel that it does limit you from a lot of really delicious and nutritious foods.
Because there are so many different ways that you can prepare soy, and we're still looking at it as a block of bean curd instead of all the delicious ways that you can prepare it. I mean, you can make buffalo wings, you can mix it in with other vegan meats like seitan and make unchicken cutlets out of it, or
you
what
can
have
make
you.
Delicious puddings and desserts and ice creams. I mean, you can make a lot of things, but you can also make them out of other foods. I just don't think soy should be the hot button issue that it is. One thing that I always assumed that whatever was bad about soy in a soybean would be 10 times worse in a soy protein isolate, right? Because they've sucked all of the good out of it and just stuck the bad in the protein isolate. The bad, in my mind back in the time, being phytoestrogens, isoflavones. But actually, there's much less phytoestrogen and isoflavones in soy protein isolate than there is in a whole soybean, which I thought was interesting.
It is one of the most delicious tasting protein powders out there because it's creamy and it mixes up really well and has a really nice amino acid profile.
I haven't had it in so long that I don't even remember what it tastes like as a protein powder. But I just always thought that if a soybean was bad for you, then, you know, the super concentrated soy must be worse for you. But actually, it appears that it's not just a hyper-concentrated form of a whole soybean, which is what I used to think. So, anyway, just an interesting thing.
Yeah.
You guys want to hear about more studies? Probably not. There's literally hundreds of them.
Sometimes I'm afraid that the information I'm receiving, and because of the communities that I run in, that perhaps I'm missing the whole picture here. And I kind of wonder, is there anyone out there that really still thinks that soy is a food that is bad for your body, for your health, hurts your ability to gain muscle? And my question here, is it just a bunch of conversation going based on old information, or is there still information being put out there about soy in the nutrition world that is talking about its harmful properties that are unfounded?
Well, I don't know about new information that's being put out that's bad about soy, but I certainly am 100% certain that there are a lot of people that still think it's basically the devil. And, you know, to your point about being in the vegan community and feeling like, you know, you're in an echo chamber, basically, you want to really learn, but you know that what you're listening to is coming from a biased voice. And, you know, that goes for you guys listening to this podcast, too. Like, you're listening to two people that have probably 35 years of veganism between us. Like, yeah, we're biased. But also, we have 35 years of veganism under our belts and are still pretty dang healthy. But when I'm researching this stuff, we talked about this earlier today, you and I deliberately will not go to vegan sites. I don't want to read any of this stuff from a vegan source. I want to read it from the least biased place that I can, because I don't particularly believe a lot of the stuff that I read on a lot of the vegan health websites that are out there. I think that veganism can be an incredibly healthy, well-balanced diet. I think for certain people, it can help them reverse certain diseases. But I don't think that a vegan diet in general, it's not a miracle drug. It's not the cure to everything. You can be vegan and still be sick. You can be vegan and still be unhealthy. And unfortunately, I feel like a lot of the vegan health sources that exist make it sound like it is absolutely impossible to eat a vegan diet or even a whole food plant-based diet and not be sick, overweight, diabetic, blah, blah, blah. And you can, of course you can. It's not a cure-all, but there are some really outstanding health benefits to a plant-based diet for most people. So we try to highlight it in the least biased way that we can by researching not vegan sources the vast majority of the time.
It's an ongoing problem where not only is veganism sensationalized as far as being the healthiest diet on earth, it's also when people, especially people who have influential power, come into this world, they monetize it, and more importantly, they're coming here for a cure for whatever health problem they have. And then when they still have the health problem and they're no longer vegan and they're not eating plant-based, they basically blame veganism for their problem.
Yeah.
And it keeps happening over and over again. And unfortunately, those who scream the loudest at the top of the mountain, who have a whole bunch of people following them for whatever reason, generally that's what winds up swaying the conversation, and that's what people see, and then they start judging a plant-based diet based on that, and that's how the misinformation can spread.
So for context, it's June 26th and John Venus became a hunter about 2.5 weeks ago. This has nothing to do with soy. We are so far from the topic, but if you guys want to hear us rant and rave about ex-vegans and, you know, how they harm the community and how they harm a lot of other people, we made a podcast about that probably like a year back, but you know, it's happening again, and it will happen again, guys. There are plenty of fake vegan type influencers out there that will, you know, the truth will come out eventually. I promise you that. But yeah, John Venus saying that he couldn't raise his daughter as vegan, and then not only did he decide he's not vegan, but he's actually going to be a hunter, which to me says you were not vegan in the first place. So we were just talking about a vegan diet and how it can be great, but you know, a poorly planned diet is not gonna go well whether you're vegan or not. You have to pay attention to your nutrition whether you're vegan or not. But veganism, as opposed to being plant-based, veganism is an ethical decision. It's something that you decide to do not because you want to lose 10 pounds. You do it because you believe in your heart that it's the best way that you can live for whatever reasons, for the animals, for the environment, for all kinds of reasons. And because it's an ethical decision, I don't think you can just stop. It means you're gonna, you know, not consume animal products either via your mouth or consume in other ways in your life. Like not going out and buying a leather jacket or going to support a zoo or blah, blah, blah. You can't just stop feeling that way. And if you can just flip on a dime overnight, then you weren't vegan in the first place. You were plant-based. And if that rubs some people the wrong way, I don't know what to tell you. So soy. So soy, overall, the vast majority of the research in like literally in the last 15 years or so has shown health benefits in humans, but possibly just because it's a plant-based food more than because it's soy specifically.
Yeah, so have at it. I mean, it would be so unfortunate if you weren't including soy in your diet simply because you were scared of one of the beans in the legume family that has the most protein and so many other health benefits to it. So once you can evaluate the reason why you're potentially avoiding enjoying soy, if it is fear-based and not allergy-based, there's really no reason to not give it a shot because there are so many different vegan foods out there that are high in protein and delicious and so many different ways to prepare it.
Yeah, and if you don't want to eat soy, you don't have to. But don't take it out of your diet because you think that you're going to grow man boobs or become highly estrogenic, because that's not true, and there are lots of reasons to include soy in your diet. And although this conversation did not go the way that I thought this conversation was going to go when we started having it, because I don't think anybody's interested in listening to me read the conclusions of 50 studies for 40 minutes. We will include them. In fact, that'll be an interesting thing to include a list of all of the studies in the show notes. We will do that for you guys. So if you want to dive into them, they'll be right there for you so you can check them out. But yeah, thank you for listening to this conversation that went very differently than we expected. All right, moving on to the questions. Here we go. I am a vegan who has a lot of dietary restrictions and also trains 4 to 5 days a week. I'm struggling to get adequate food in, as well as struggling with binge eating junk food every couple of days. Is this something you have experienced with giving nutrition plans?
So we're looking at someone who is struggling to get adequate food in, and in their attempt to get the right kind of food in or enough, I'm not quite sure exactly what's going on there, I would need more context, but the point is that as they're trying to eat a certain amount of food or eat a certain way, they wind up eventually getting into the cycle of binge eating. So all kinds of things here come to mind. The first thing that I would do when I want to make sure that I am programming for my goals and my caloric needs is to food track. And we say this over and over again, but it's true. But it's not only about tracking, it's about keeping a food diary. Because once you start to take a look at the types of foods you're eating based on how much you're eating, I mean how many calories you're getting in, sometimes you could have a whole lot of food on your plate, but that food is very voluminous, so you might feel overfull. However, you're not eating enough. And then you wind up perhaps binge eating on foods that are calorically dense and hyperpalatable because you need to eat more, but you get into this cycle where you're just bulk eating for a couple of days and feeling like you're missing out on eating nutritionally dense whole foods. Now, I'm playing out this one scenario, but I really don't know what this person is going through specifically, which is why I would always start right in the beginning and find out what kind of food you're eating. The alternative could be when someone is perhaps not eating enough, or they're taking a reductionist approach to how they're eating in any kinds of ways, like avoiding certain types of foods. And then eventually, because they're either severely under eating or they're avoiding certain kinds of foods that they could sprinkle in moderation and enjoy because they're going to eat them again eventually anyhow, when it comes to a certain point a week or two later, they wind up gorging on these foods or just gorging on food in general because they're just not eating enough. So these are two different scenarios, for example, that once again, I go back to my point, pay attention to the kinds of foods you're eating, not just how much you're eating, and keep some sort of a food journal, and then start to ask these questions, and you might have answers to as far as to why you're getting into this cycle of binge eating. And yes, this is something that is all too common. All right, here's our next question. Hi there, a question for the podcast. Is it true that you can't build muscle when you're in a caloric deficit? I've been trying to heal my quadricep tendinosis with a doc and PT, which includes building strength in some nearby weaker muscles. I haven't made much progress, so I wondered if the fact that I'm in a cut could be affecting that. Thanks.
So this is a really good question, and we have kind of touched upon this before in podcasts, but if it's possible to build muscle in a caloric deficit, or if it's possible to lose fat and build muscle at the same time, is a very similar question. It's possible, but only under very specific conditions. So some of those conditions would be if you're very young, if you're a teenager, it might be possible for you. If you have a lot of weight to lose, like 50 plus pounds, you can probably build muscle in a caloric deficit. If you have taken a long break from training, like a year, if you're in your first year of training, or if you are on performance-enhancing drugs, under those circumstances, it's fairly easy to build muscle while in a caloric deficit. Now, because the muscles around your quadricep tendinosus are so weak, and they probably haven't been trained this way before. It's almost like those muscles have taken a big break from the gym. So it may be possible to build some muscle up in those areas, even in a deficit. However, given the fact that you're dealing with an injury, your body is going to require more energy to heal that injury. If you put yourself back at caloric maintenance or even in a slight caloric surplus, all that additional nutrition is going to be very helpful in one, aiding those weak muscles to get stronger, and two, sending blood and vitamins and oxygen to the area to help repair it. So a lot of times when one of my clients, like they have an injury or they're sick, you know, sick with a cold or something, not like sick with a stomach flu. I would never suggest this in that case. But, you know, particularly, let's say if they're injured and they can't train as much as they normally train. A lot of knee-jerk questions are like, well, should I cut my calories if I can't train as much? And my answer 90% of the time is like, no, keep your calories where they are. Those additional calories are going to help you heal up faster. I think cutting calories because you're injured is only going to prolong an injury. And then this person also asked just a real quick question, said another quick question. I saw on your YouTube video that you keep your giant bag of Vital Wheat gluten in the freezer. Is this just to preserve freshness?
Yeah. And the other thing is we don't want to risk having flour bugs, flour spoils. And so, yeah, not just like so it tastes good, but also so that it keeps for a long period of time.
Yeah, we keep a lot of our different flours in the freezer. We keep sugar in the freezer. It does preserve the freshness. I've never seen bugs in Vital Wheat gluten before, but I also don't want to find them in a 50-pound bag. So keep them in there for that. I have seen bugs in regular flour, so I've frozen that for as long as I can remember.
I think I can interject here and give you a helpful tip. And for those of you who do not have a chest freezer, which, by the way, highly recommend the chest freezer if you have the space. $125, you can throw bulk foods in there. If you don't have the space or the budget for a chest freezer, you can get the giant, what are they, like gallon bags or something like that, Ziploc bags, and you can partition the 50-pound bag of gluten into like 5 or 6 of these bags, and then it actually fits, the vast majority of it will fit in your freezer, even if you have a regular sized freezer, and you can put one of those bags in your pantry.
Yeah, you don't have to store it in the freezer. I have plenty of clients who have the same bag and they don't, but if you have a way to freeze it, I probably would. Anyway, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode of Muscles by Brussels Radio. I appreciate you sticking around while that podcast kind of went sideways, but I think it was a good discussion. If you have anything you'd like us to discuss or you have any questions that you would like to have answered on this podcast, please shoot us a message, veganproteins@gmail.com, or you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, veganproteins and at Muscles by Brussels. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please go ahead and leave it a review wherever you're listening to it. It really helps us get the podcast out there and in front of fresh eyes of people who might need to hear this information and wouldn't otherwise find it. Thanks so much for tuning in. My name is Danny.
And I'm Giacomo.
And we will talk to you soon.